Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Gary Rivlin, author of Katrina, After the Flood. We'll also hear from Fatima Sheikh, whose new collection of short stories is What Went Missing and What Got Found. Gary Rivlin is a former reporter for the New York Times, now an investigative reporting fellow at the Nation Institute. His list of reporting credentials is long and outstanding, and he is also the author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. His impressive new book, A Very Long Time in the Making, is Katrina, After the Flood. Gary Rivlin, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much.
So you came here initially as a reporter. When did you know you would write a book? What was the tipping point for making that decision?
Arriving here, most everyone was looking at that first week. But my obsession, I got here a week after Katrina, my obsession from the moment I walked into this city, there's still water everywhere, there are dead bodies, was like, what are they going to do? 80% of the city's covered by water. You know, there's virtually no schools, all the utilities were damaged, no 911, no commerce. How are they going to rebuild? And that was just my fascination from the moment. It kind of started off in this nerdy, wonky place, like, how do you pull this off? And I just grew fascinated by that. And the more I thought about it, the more complicated it becomes. Like, okay, you say, I'm going to move back, but you got to worry about your next door neighbor. You got to worry about the school around the corner. You got to worry, you know, for a few months there, like, would the city even give you garbage service and police protection? Right? Shrink the footprint. And so, you know, by a few months into it, it's like, wow, there might be an extraordinary book to be written here. So that's about when it arrived in my brain.
Long term. So with so many characters to choose from, how did you narrow your focus? How did you choose the folks you concentrated on in this book?
Well, I mean, I had an advantage in that I had met a slew of people in those first weeks after the storm. One of the main characters in the book is Alden McDonald, the president of Liberty Bank. I met him 10, 11 days after Katrina. But, you know, there was this moment a few years back where, you know, I called it my casting call. So I've got, you know, 15, 20 characters. I know their stories and all, but how am I going to fit it all together? I kind of boiled it down to three main characters, one through whom I was going to tell the story of Lakeview, one through whom I wanted to tell the story of the Lower Ninth Ward, and one through whom I wanted to tell the story of New Orleans East. And in each case, like, the Lower Ninth Ward doesn't have a great outcome, right? I mean, it's 10 years after the storm and it's barely one third back. So the character, the human being, the person I chose for that story, I thought reflected that. You know, the Lakeview story, the opposite. I mean, Lakeview, I'd say, is 100% plus maybe back. And so that was somebody who let me tell that story. And New Orleans East fitting somewhere in between. Like, I wanted a character who didn't come back. I mean, it's 10 years after Katrina. There's nearly 100,000 less African-Americans in the city today than compared to 10 years ago. So I needed a character who didn't come back. And so, you know, I kind of reverse engineered knowing how I wanted to end up. And that helped me sort it through.
So let's talk about some of these people. I mean, one of the great strengths of this book is that it's a rare New Orleanian who's not going to know some of these people or know of them. So let's talk about Alden McDonald, because Liberty Bank is such an important part of our community.
I was first sent down here. I was sitting in San Francisco covering Silicon Valley, Google going public, you know, Facebook, all that stuff, when my phone rang and like, hey, we need somebody to go to the Gulf Coast. It wasn't even necessarily New Orleans specific at that point, to find a single business hit hard by the storm so you could chronicle their struggle to rebuild. And I meet Alden McDonald rather quickly. He was open to it, but seven out of his eight branches had been flooded or hit by looters. 80% of his customer base was flooded. Their headquarters was flooded. Their records were destroyed. And so I call my editor, like, I think I have the business, but I think we have to be prepared for the FDIC, for the federal regulators, to come in and say, we're closing down this bank because it's not going to make it. Because people, the regulators and Alden McDonald himself, were really worried early on. And so once Liberty was able to rebuild and, in fact, become bigger and stronger than ever, it's now the fourth largest Black-owned financial institution in the country. I just knew that was an extraordinary story. And Alden McDonald also gave me access. You know, I would talk to him once a week, and I just was watching as he was piecing it together. I mean, his home was destroyed. His business was destroyed. The community he had helped given rise to, the eastern half of New Orleans, you know, Liberty dates back to the 70s when pretty much no one was offering bank loans to African-Americans, but an African-American-owned bank. So New Orleans East, Gentilly, the Ninth Ward, Seventh Ward, those communities were able to grow in large part because of Liberty. So I just knew by telling Liberty's story, I'd be able to tell the story of the eastern half of the city, which of course was decimated by the flooding. And there was just the intimacy, the access. You know, I saw his home a few days after he saw it for the first time when it was flooded. 3 years later, he had moved back to his home, and, you know, I went there for dinner. I mean, so I had access to the story. So that was an easy one. I always knew that Alton McDonald was going to be one of my main characters.
Well, one of the most impressive pieces of writing in this book is his first drive back into the city. Because if you're a New Orleanian, you remember. You remember that tension. You remember seeing all that destruction on the outskirts, no matter what direction you were coming in from. And, you know, I could feel my shoulders start to tense up a little bit in sympathy, because I knew exactly how he felt. And that was just a perfect, perfect description.
You know, it's interesting that one of the challenges in writing a book like this, anyone approaching Katrina, is everyone has their Katrina story. Everyone wants to tell you the Katrina story. And everyone's Katrina story is fascinating. So I didn't want to have everyone seeing their home for the first time and everyone talking about the first time they saw it on TV that the city was flooded and worried that, you know, is my home destroyed? So in that case, I had that experience like a half dozen times of going with people and seeing their home. But I told it through Alden McDonald because I thought that would be the most vivid. And thank you. I love that section.
It's a really, really good section. And then there are the Wall sisters, who are New Orleans to the bone. I mean, Cassandra, Tangi, whom I know slightly, Petey, Contess, and the cousin Robin, the fifth sister. And they are so charming and fun to read about. So talk about the dilemmas they faced.
Well, so how I met them was really interesting. I was here the week after Katrina. And I largely was based in Baton Rouge, the New York Times. We had a bunch of reporters here. We'd rotate rooms at the Sheraton. There are a few rooms, and we'd all take turns for a few nights. So Baton Rouge was home base for the first few weeks for me. And I needed clothes. I needed supplies. So I go to the Walmart, and there's this handwritten photocopied sign. Are you from New Orleans East? Are you frustrated that there's no information out there? Come to this meeting at the Baptist Church at, you know, Monday at 5 p.m. And I just show up. And it turns out the Wall sisters, who I wouldn't say they were apolitical before Katrina, but they weren't the community activist type. But again, they're watching the news. No one's talking about New Orleans East. New Orleans East represents about one-fifth of the population of the city. It's the Black middle class, the Black professional class, the Black elite in New Orleans. And so I just went to this meeting and I met them, and they all kind of pinky cinched vow, like, we're all going to come back. But it wasn't that easy. I mean, do you have the money to come back? If you have children, what about school? Do you put yourself first? Do you put your child first? And so, you know, there was a lot of struggle and some resentment, because in everyone's mind, the five of them, the four sisters and cousin Robin, were moving back. But, you know, after 3, 4, 5, 6 months and you don't get the insurance payment you anticipate, the road home money was a little bit short, you're thinking New Orleans East, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years after Katrina, it was pretty stark still. And so, you know, I was there for the optimism, and then I was there for kind of the next phase when reality sunk in.
Because this does cover such a long period of time, which is one of the great things about this book. And you also talk about some of the really prominent civic leaders of the period, Joe Cannizzaro, Boise Bollinger, politicians, you know, so that must have been fun for you to talk with them and see what was going on with them.
Joe Catanzaro, one of my favorite characters, let's just say he's a little bit more conservative than I am in my politics, but I had written a feature story about him early on as sort of, you know, the mogul who was going to help decide New Orleans' future. He's personal friends with President Bush. He's a New Orleanian. He was close to Ray Nagin at that time. And the morning the story appears, 9 a.m., my cell phone rings. And like, trust me, if the person you're writing about calls you at 9 in the morning, like 9 out of 10 times, it's not going to be a very pleasant conversation. But he starts off, "Gary, just got off the phone with Karl Rove." And the both of us were amazed. The New York Times could be fair to somebody like me. And he just gave me access. The big Wednesday meeting, "I don't know you, Joe Catanzaro, but I hate you." It's early January at the Sheraton Hotel. The previous Saturday, he'd invited me to the final meeting they were having to finalize the plan. And I'm just sitting there, you know, while they're just arguing and not making up their mind about what I felt were pretty key things. And so, you know, I had access to Catanzaro. And, you know, it's interesting. I actually think that Ray Nagin, African-American, a Democrat from a fairly liberal city, relatively speaking, ended up with the free market solution. Everybody's off on their own. You want to rebuild your community, you could rebuild your community. Joe Catanzaro, very conservative, he ended up with kind of the more community activist solution. No, we need to help every neighborhood figure out what to do. We need to spend government money to bring them the experts and the planners they need to figure out their city. I actually thought that in the end, Catanzaro played an unfortunate role in that it was too idealistic. It wasn't workable what he came up with, but his heart was in the right place. Mm-hmm. It was up to him early on. He was going to say, "I'm sorry. A city for 600,000 plus people that was 455,000 at the time of Katrina and might not have more than 300,000 post-Katrina," which ended up being wrong. "You can't rebuild the whole city." But as he told me, you know, "I'm a white man in a majority African-American city. How am I going to tell all these African-American communities, I'm sorry, because of past racial injustice, because of racial covenants, because you couldn't have home ownership in the old part of town, it had to be the newer communities, which are the lower lying communities, we're going to tell you you can't rebuild it." It was such a struggle. It was such a dilemma. And I think his heart was in the right place, even if it wasn't practical what he was thinking about.
And you're pretty clear-eyed about the politicians of this period, too. Ray Nagin, Mitch Landrieu, Blanco.
God, it was New Orleans' great misfortune to have a neophyte as mayor at the time of Katrina. I mean, there's part of me that's sympathetic for Ray Nagin. I mean, it would be impossible for any mayor to figure this out. But, you know, somebody with no experience, no allies, and quite frankly, no ability to say, "Hey, I need a lot of help here." And so it was, you know, people around him, Ron Foreman, Sally Foreman, you know, other advisors would talk about Nagin ray-raying. Yes. Yeah, don't worry, everything's under control. Don't worry, man, don't worry. And it's just like, but everything wasn't under control. And I think he put most of his effort into looking like he was in charge. You know, the lesson of Rudy Giuliani after September 11th is just appear in charge. Well, that's part of it, and that's important. But you also have to start coming up with a plan. So, I mean, I look at those first four and a half years after Katrina that Ray Nagin was mayor as just wasted years.
Now, you've said that a lot of the work you did for this book involved reading the other Katrina books, reading lots of journalism. So what's the percentage of boots on the ground work you did and literary research? I mean, how did you make that work?
Right. So I'm based in New York. So for the last 3.5 years, I've been coming down to New Orleans every other month for a week or so, 10 days, depending on the trip. So, you know, most of what's in this book is reported. I mean, I was here for the first 8 months after Katrina, and, you know, much of the book is based on those first 8 months I was here. But with that said, there was some extraordinary journalism locally, nationally. There were some great books, especially about those first days and weeks after Katrina. So I would look at it as sort of source material, looking for little gems and jewels I could find in the various pieces of work that are written. And, you know, I give a nod to it in the narrative and at the end of the book. I kind of spell out more times when I took a quote from someone. I mean, there was so much media attention. I mean, anyone in New Orleans knows that. In those first weeks and months, you couldn't help just bump into the CNN reporters, the NPR reporters, or us New York Times reporters. So there was just so much to read through and all. And, you know, I mean, some of it was almost nostalgic, you know, for me. Like, it's interesting. New Orleans, for me, before Katrina, I was your typical tourist. I mean, when I was younger, I came from Mardi Gras a couple of times, and I made the transition to Jazz Fest a couple of times. Always loved the food, the culture, but mainly, like, the Big Easy that, you know, I could move a little bit slower here. I like the pace of life is a great place to take a break, but that really wasn't and didn't end up being my connection to New Orleans that helps explain why I spent much of the last 10 years on Katrina. It was more, I was here in those first weeks and months, and I'm talking to people who lost everything, and then I'm reading quotes from Washington about, oh, we shouldn't give them money. You know, they're going to steal it anyway, or why should we rebuild this city when it's, you know, so low-lying, and lots of misinformation. You know, I'm getting mad as people are realizing, wait, this is largely a man-made disaster. Yeah. It's not Katrina. It wasn't the hurricane. It was the flood that followed the hurricane. And so, you know, I started to get mad like a local. You know, I really resented.
Thank you.
No, I really resented that the misinformation and the lack of acknowledgement, like, hey, wait a second, you know, you did play a bit of a role here, if not a huge role, federal government, you know, like you really need to step up.
Well, my real question is, what do you want people to take away from this? Because part of the thing is, you know, a New Orleans reader will pick this up and will feel familiarity with the people, familiarity with the dilemmas, affection for their hometown, as always. But a lot of them will go, I don't know, you know, I've moved on. I don't need to look back at this. So, you know, there's a difference between a New Orleans reader and a non-New Orleans reader. So what do you think when you think about that? Who do you want to take away what from what you've done?
To me, people talk about the New Orleans miracle. In those first weeks and months, it wasn't clear the city was going to come back the way it did. But I really think it's a half a miracle that, you know, this place is thrumming with energy, young energy. There's an entrepreneurial spirit. You know, there's some communities that are really turning around and thriving. But, you know, there's the other half of the story. I mean, it's 10 years after Katrina, and the 7th Ward is maybe 2/3 back. Pontchartrain Park, historic Black community, is maybe 75% back. The Lower 9th Ward is barely back. It's 1/3 back. New Orleans East, right? A largely prosperous community, or at least a lot of middle-class, professional-class people are living there. And, you know, I call it an Alden McDonald's. It's 80% back 10 years after Katrina. So, you know, for locals especially, I just want them to realize, like, yes, there's a lot to brag about with what's going on in New Orleans, you know, the new Hollywood South and, you know, all that great stuff. Central Business District is looking well, but there's big parts of the city that are still struggling and might feel a little, if not a lot, resentful about everyone taking a bow for, you know, the victory. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, mission accomplished of George Bush on the aircraft carrier after Iraq. It's like, I'm not really sure he's ready to take the bow quite yet.
Well, don't quit watching. I mean, that's all I can say to you. We've been talking with Gary Rivlin, whose wonderful new book is Katrina After the Flood, one of the must-reads of this summer season. You can meet him Wednesday, August 26th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Gary, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
T'étais pas là quand j'ai passé. Elle t'a été à le soir. T'étais pas là quand j'ai passé. Et j'ai trouvé dans la mauvaise bouillie. Tous les jours, c'est pas la même.
Fatima Sheikh is New Orleans through and through. A native of our city, she's written many books about New Orleans. The novella collection, The Mayor of New Orleans, Just Talkin' Jazz, the beautiful picture books, The Jazz of Our Street and On Mardi Gras Day, the young adult novel, Malite, and now a collection of fabulous short stories called What Went Missing and What Got Found. Fatima, welcome to The Reading Life.
I'm happy to be here, Susan.
Now, this is such an impressive collection. It's so full of real voices of real New Orleanians. How long have you been working on these stories? What time period do these cover in your life?
Well, in my life, the stories cover the last 30 years, really. I've been writing short stories whenever I had extra time, because I love short stories. I love the form. So I'd write something, and then I'd let it sit for a while. So some of them you'll find that are really early stories, one that appeared in the Southern Review, I guess, about 30 years ago. And then some are very recent. There are a couple in there that I wrote in the last 6 months. So they really span across the board.
Now, you're a New Orleans native, and you live in New York, and you teach at St. Peter's University, but you've never lost that New Orleans style of yours.
No, I love New Orleans. I mean, you know, it's funny when I joke with people that I work in New York, but I live in New Orleans because I really feel alive when I'm home.
And you have so much family here.
Well, everybody in my family is in New Orleans, except those that moved after Katrina. But when I left, nobody had lived away, really, not for any length of time. Everybody had gone away for a little while, but most had come back. So I was the only one that stayed.
You know, I wouldn't really class this as a Katrina book. You know, I think people have certain preconceptions about that. But several of the stories do deal with the flood. And one of the most moving is the hotels. And I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about how that story came to you and evolved over time.
It started out, I wanted to write three stories from three different perspectives, so I had this trilogy in mind. I also had heard so many stories, that last third of the book, you know, where I had talked to people, I had come down after the storm several times, so all those emotions were there. And then sort of in my logical brain, I kept seeing, like everybody else, so many people outside and all of those hotels. You know, I mean, I didn't hear anybody really talking about all the hotels that were in New Orleans. I mean, we're a city of hotels, yet all of these people were outside on the street. So that gave me pause.
Mm-hmm. And you have this fabulous couple in that story, Sweet Pea and Davis.
Oh, you like them?
I love them. I love them so much. You know, they've been together a long time. They obviously love each other beyond measure. I wonder if you'd talk about developing their characters, because they're so true to the city to me.
I think Sweet Pea and Davis were those kind of characters that you don't sort of develop. There are some characters that you think of in advance and you say, I would like to write a story and this might be a main character, right? But Sweet Pea and Davis just sort of came to me with voices. Their voices came to me. That's sort of like the mayor of New Orleans. The mayor of New Orleans came to me in voices. You know, I just heard the voice and I followed the voice as opposed to thinking about a plot or anything like that.
Well, there's a lot of love in their voices. I think that's why I'm drawn to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, good. I'm glad you liked it.
Well, and the other thing you said, there's a lot of that kind of hard-won New Orleans wisdom about women and men in this book, too.
There is. I don't know why it came out. I found myself writing a lot about women in this book, and even though I'm a female writer, I write a lot of men and women characters, you know? But I found myself sort of looking at it from both sides.
Yeah, it's like Sweet Pea saying, you know, sometimes you just have to say you're sorry. That was just perfect.
Right, right.
Oh.
I think that was Davis, if that's what you're talking about. Davis said,
yes.
Sometimes sorry isn't enough. Sometimes you just have to say it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being sorry, I don't know. It's better when I write it.
And there's also, of course, a lot of drinking and a lot of wry humor in this book.
Yeah, right? That's kind of New Orleans, isn't it?
It is. Well, one of the things that I love is in this wonderful story about Thomas, Life is for the Living, who goes to sit in the cemetery every day. And you have this paragraph that I think is so great. And so forgive me for reading it not in your voice. But
I want to hear it.
Who in New Orleans has not said some novena, climbed up some church steps on their knees, taken home in a bottle some holy water or bones and dirt and a cloth? And it had worked out just as expected. Not one of the men at the loading dock or even in all of downtown New Orleans was exempt. They believed anything was possible so often that the miraculous was ordinary. Now, is that really how you feel about New Orleans?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is how I feel. I feel like New Orleans, the miraculous, is sort of a daily occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
You just feel it. You feel it when you're there. You feel a spirit when you're in New Orleans. And it does feel like anything can happen at any moment. And you would tell somebody and they'd say, oh, sure, that's right.
And I think that spiritual overlay, that comfort with it, I think, is one of the things you write about so beautifully.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, it is a spiritual place, and I believe in the spirit, you know, so I guess that's why I'm so hooked into New Orleans.
And you've got a little bit of your New York experience in here, too.
Yes, I do. What is that, Maurice, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I know. See, you talk about these characters as if they're your best friends after you've read this book, which is why I like it. Oh.
I talk to them, you know. Poor Maurice. He's a nice guy. But, you know, I had a friend that told me once, and that always stuck with me. I had a friend once who came to New York, and he said, you know, the worst thing about New York is people will look at you in the face and they won't say hello. And that just stuck with me, you know? And that's what Maurice is having a problem in New York, because he goes around and he'll look at people who'll be standing next to them and no one will see him at all.
Never happens here, huh?
Never.
So I have to ask you, since you've written about Katrina, how will you be observing this anniversary?
Well, I'm coming to New Orleans. I just couldn't do it up here. I'll be there at Dillard on the 26th. I'm going to be reading. I'm going to be in the 7th Ward with the Neighborhood Association. We were able to get 300 books that we're going to hand out to children.
Oh, great.
To kids in the 7th Ward. And I wanted to do that. You know, I just felt like I needed to do something.
Great. Well, I think that's a perfect way to observe it. Handing out books, you know, that would be something I very much approve of.
I know you would like it.
Oh, we've been talking with Fatima Sheikh, whose wonderful new story collection is What Went Missing and What Got Found. You can meet her Tuesday, August 18th at 6 at Octavia Books, and then again at Dillard, August 26th. Fatima, thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Luncheon of the Boating Party by Susan Vreeland, Saturday, August 15th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. George Sanchez signs his Jeff Chaussier Mysteries, Explorations End and Lit by Lightning, Saturday, August 15th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Dana Ginther signs The Woman in the Photograph, Sunday, August 16th at 2 at Octavia Books. There will be a Dog Days open mic Sunday, August 16th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Today's guest, Fatima Sheikh, signs What Went Missing and What Got Found, Tuesday, August 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. Cynthia Joyce presents Please Forward, How Blogging Reconnected New Orleans After Katrina, Tuesday, August 18th at 7:30 upstairs in the Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude. Today's guest, Gary Rivlin, signs Katrina After the Flood, Wednesday, August 26th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. And great news for University of New Orleans English professor Anne Boyd Rue, who has won a Public Scholar Award from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Her grant of $50,400 is the maximum amount that can be given under the Public Scholar Program, and it will support the writing of her book, Reading Little Women, The History of an American Classic. She's writing a biography of the novel that illuminates how Louisa May Alcott's classic was written and how it has been read ever since. In 2018, Little Women will turn 150 years old. Congratulations, Anne. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.